to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. Dr. Jamie Seaman. Super excited to be back here. And thank you guys so much for all the love on our previous episodes. Thanks for every download, every review that you leave us, all the likes and shares, even those of you following on YouTube. I appreciate it. And it helps us spread our message to the entire world. I'm super excited to be joined today by one of my colleagues. He is a fellow OBGYN and also has a background in integrative medicine. So we see eye to eye on so many things. But I want to introduce you to Dr. Sean Tassone. He's not only a medical doctor, but has a PhD. He's known as America's holistic gynecologist, and he was the first physician in the United States to be double board certified in both obstetrics and gynecology and by the American Board of Integrative Medicine. He holds a medical degree in addition to his PhD, like I said, in mind-body medicine, and he's practicing OBGYN down in Austin, Texas. He's a hormone specialist. He's an author. We're going to talk about his new book. He's a speaker. He's highly rated patient advocate and creator of the world's first integrative hormonal mapping system. In his 20 plus years of practice, Dr. Tassone has seen over 40,000 women, and he is determined to remove the myths surrounding women's health. And of course, I applaud him in that effort. As an integrative health practitioner, he believes that you should have an active role in your care. His work includes studies and publications on hormonal imbalances, spirituality in medical care, whole foods to heal the human body, and integrative medicine. Dr. Tassone is featured in many publications like the New York Times, NBC News Online, Stanford Med, and of course, his brand new book that he just wrote called The Hormone Balance Bible. And we're going to dive into this thing. It's published by HarperCollins and it's now available for purchase. So we'll link it for all of you as well in the podcast. Dr. Tassone, welcome.
Thanks. I think I'm just going to leave now because after that intro, I don't want to mess anything up. So I'm just going to leave and let everybody think how awesome I am.
No, we have so much to get into and so much value that you're going to provide to all these listeners. So I can't let you leave now, but I know you've been busy seeing patients today. So
yeah. Got to pay the bills still.
Well, I don't know what you can add to that intro. It was pretty fabulous, but tell us a little bit about yourself for people that don't follow you and don't know who you are and don't know your story.
Well, like you said, I mean, I was trained, actually, you're Mrs. Nebraska. I went to medical school at Creighton in Omaha. And so I did traditional medical training, did my residency in Oklahoma. And then in 2000, my mom passed away. And I was a second year resident. So I knew a lot about ovarian cancer and I knew what the treatments were. But what I found was that when she was sick after her chemo treatments, I couldn't help my own mother. Like I couldn't, her joints hurt or, you know, she just felt bad and I didn't know what to do. And so when she passed away, I kind of went on, I'm an only child. So I kind of went on my own little journey and that's where I did the integrative medicine training. And then in the integrative program, there was an 8-week program on spirituality and health. And that just kind of took me in another direction. And after I'd spent a lot of money in training and stuff, I figured, well,
so much money,
you know, the story, when you go into a labyrinth, you have to come back out to share the message with people or else what's the journey worth? So I kind of felt like that's where I was after I came back through all that, that it was time for me to put stuff together. And so that's the culmination of all that would be the book and then all my patients' stories and things like that.
Amazing. How long did it take you to write the Hormone Balance Bible?
Well, what I had originally thought was a good book probably wasn't. So it had been rewritten a few times, probably in total about 4 to 5 years.
Yeah. It's definitely a labor of love and a process to put it together. And it's like sending your baby out into the world.
When I first got my first box of books, I think I got them on a Friday and I didn't open the box for probably 2 or 3 days because I didn't even want to look at the book because I was afraid I would find errors or I would be like, oh, it's horrible. And it's funny because you just have that self-doubt. And then when I looked at it, finally, I was like, oh, it's actually pretty good. I mean, you spend all that time on it and then you kind of come to almost dislike it because you've read it so many times. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, people are now coming out and sharing stories with me online It's been really rewarding.
Yeah. Well, I know when I got it, I went and did the quiz and found out what my archetype is. And we'll tell people kind of how this book is structured, because that was one thing when I was reading. It's very different than, you know, other books. And I applaud you. It's I can tell the work that you've put into it. So you and I both have completed training in integrative medicine, which is different than a lot of our colleagues. So, you know, there's additional training you can do after being an OBGYN doctor. You can go into these fellowships like reproductive endocrinology, maternal fetal medicine, GYN oncology, and a few others. But functional medicine and integrative medicine are something that any doctor can do. For those of you that don't, you know, understand what it is, it's looking at other adjunctive therapies that complement Western medicine. We're not totally rejecting Western medicine, but obviously we both had reasons why we pursued those. And I think many doctors do, is because they see maybe the problems that just traditional Western medicine, that we encounter with patients, you know, with our limited options. So tell me a little bit about kind of that journey into integrative medicine and like where you feel like we've gone wrong with Western medicine and what we provide to women and women's health.
When I did integrative medicine, I think I did the program between 2005 and 2007 at the University of Arizona. So it was a while ago. And I remember at the time doing it, I was reading a book by Andrew Weil called 8 Weeks to Optimum Health. And it was pretty funny because 16 years ago, he was talking about CoQ10 and fish oil. And it was like mind blowing at the time, like, oh, I can't even imagine this is a thing. And it's definitely come quite a long way since then. But when I was in that training, the word functional was just kind of getting thrown around a little bit. So functional medicine wasn't even a thing. That's only been out for maybe the last 5 to 7 years, full force. But I think what happens is when I graduated from residency, we had this saying in the residency that you heal with steel. Like, you were surgeons, we cut things, we use forceps, we're invasive, you know, and we actually, as residents, kind of in a weird way took pride in that. You know, how many hysterectomies have you done? How many C-sections have you done? Because it's a very competitive environment.
Yeah, like, we're a surgical specialty, so there's requirements when we come through. For people that don't know, like, you have to do so many C-sections, so many deliveries, so many hysterectomies to go through this type of training.
Well, that, and you want to, when you get out, you want to know how to do stuff. And that's by doing it in residency. So when you're under the protection of your attendings and things like that. So it's a good environment, and I probably the best time of my life. But I think we come out of that mold, at least when I trained, and I got out in 98 from residency. There was no integrative medicine, and everybody, you were kind of like, you know, medications and surgeries, and that's how we did things. And I think what happens is, at least in my age group, probably you have to have a life-changing event to really go in that direction. Like, you're sick yourself, or you have a family member like I did that was sick, and you realize that you just don't, even as a doctor. So I had great access to the gynecs that were taking care of my mother, but I still felt helpless. I can't even imagine what it feels like if you're not in the medical field. Mm-hmm. I think what integrative medicine does, as well as functional medicine, is it gives you more power back, because a lot of those therapies are self-care things. And that's what we're learning is, I traveled around the world doing my PhD and worked with a lot of indigenous shamanic healers in different countries. And what I found was that they don't have MRIs, they don't have, but what they have is a connection to the place where they live and to the people that live there. And that alone makes a huge difference. And a lot of what they use are herbs, you know, rituals and ceremonies, and things like that. And obviously there's still disease processes that need medications and whatnot. But that's the integrative part for me, is also building a team around myself, like acupuncturists and herbalists and things like that I can refer to. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to people like what your interpretation of the differences between integrative medicine and functional medicine are?
You know, it's interesting. So integrative to me means that I think integrative medicine is more encompassing. Like, it's we've learned a lot about different modes of medicine, like chiropractic and acupuncture, Chinese medicine. We learn about all those, and we, like I said, we try to incorporate those healing modalities. We may not, like I said, I don't do acupuncture, but I can refer to somebody. But I know when it would be a good idea maybe to refer to acupuncturists. Functional to me is, like you said earlier, any physician, nurse practitioner, PA can be a functional practitioner. They focus more on blood lab testing, and also, at least in the terminology, getting more to the root cause of the problem. So like in our practice, if you have a lady that say has irregular periods, rather than putting her directly on birth control pills, a functional practitioner would draw labs and maybe try to get to the root cause of, you know, if she has PCOS, what's going to make the PCOS better rather than covering it up with a birth control pill.
Yeah, completely agree. Completely agree. So, you've been around in practice a little bit longer than I have. Where did we go wrong? Like, you know, I feel like we really have done women a disservice over the years in, you know, and we could make all the comparisons to, you know, male dominated fields and things like that. But, like, where did we go wrong?
I think one thing is we've probably, it's medicine, unfortunately, has become a game of money. I think that, you know, not that we as, it bothers me when people think we are bought by big pharmacy, or because most physicians I know could care less about the lunch they come and buy you or the pens they used to give us. It's, you know, I can buy my own pens. But I think what they are very influential with the insurance companies. I think that, you know, the doctor-patient relationship has been taken over by insurances telling us what to do. I think doctors are burned out. You know, when I was doing obstetrics, which I don't do anymore, I was seeing 40 to 50 patients a day. And what's funny is I think there's a thought process that maybe we're being greedy, but when I ran my practice to keep the lights on, it's $30,000 to $40,000 a month just to do that. And so the only person that's making that money is me. And so I have to keep working if I'm going to pay those bills. And I think what happens is as insurance rates go down and, you know, overhead goes up, we feel more inclined to see more people. And then we, because you have a 5-minute, 10-minute visit and we're worn out, we're just not able to spend time. And I think that's the main thing is if we could sit down and spend time with patients, and that's part of in my book is not necessarily just saying, oh, you have menopause, but listening to the story of the menopause, like, what is she saying? She's not sleeping. It's interfering with her sex life. You know, rather than just putting her on a medication, which might help some of that, understanding the storyline. And that's why I did the 12 archetypes in the book is because what I found when I was talking to patients was they understand the stories. They connect better with the stories than me just telling them, I think it might be estrogen dominance or, you know, low testosterone or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So for those of you that haven't seen the Hormone Balance Bible, it's written differently, like I said, than many books. And Dr. Tassone has kind of created these hormonal archetypes and uses that as a way to describe, like classical clinical presentations that we see on a daily basis. And so, and they're named one, that's like the queen, the unbalanced heroine, the mother, the wise woman, the workaholic, the saboteur, the nun, the warrior, the underdog, the overachiever, the chairwoman, the philosopher. So let's pick some of these archetypes and talk about them. What's your favorite one? Do you have a favorite?
Well, I can tell you the most common one, and I thought going into this that the most common one would be the estrogen dominant because of obesity and exogenous hormones and all the things that we, you know, have in the food supply and things like that. But actually, over and above all the other ones in all the age groups was testosterone deficiency, which is the nun. And I think it's for a lot of reasons, but I think as a profession, we really don't look at testosterone in women very often. I think that, you know, you, for instance, you have a great muscle mass. You work out a lot, you do stuff. You need a good amount of testosterone, and there's normals for men and women. And I think that we often blow women off and say, oh, you don't need that. You know, if you're tired, you're just getting older. But testosterone deficiency, definitely number one, decreased libido is like the plague of the 21st century for women. I think that men are getting all juiced up on steroids at every corner. You know, there's a testosterone clinic. So we're juicing up all these guys, but we're not taking care of their partners. So that's number one. Number two would be excess estrogen. And that's for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. But I think a close third is the underdog, which is hypothyroidism. And I think that, again, similar to testosterone, as doctors, this is the other thing I think we kind of miss. We look at normal or abnormal. And when I look at labs, I look at normal and abnormal, but I kind of look at it like you're either in the house or you're not in the house. So if you're in the house and it's normal, but where are you in the house? So you could be laying on the floor in the basement. That's technically normal, but that may not feel good for you as an individual. Like somebody like you that's super active, you know, maybe you would feel better around the 50th percentile of normal than down around the 10th percentile of normal. So I still work in the normal ranges. It's just that I'd like to bump people up sometimes into a little bit higher in that normal range. And that's kind of how I work. But those three, low testosterone, high estrogen, and low normal thyroid are probably the top three.
Yeah. Okay. So like for these three most common archetypes, there's obviously clinical features like that you and I would be looking for and asking about. But one of the most common things that I get asked about is, I think this is my hormones. Can you test my hormones? And obviously, you know, my doctor brain, I already have an idea before I've even tested the patient's labs as to what's going on, but they want a blood test or they want a test. So let's talk about the different ways. Can you go through the different ways to test hormones? What's like the pros and cons of some of these that they could tease out if they were seeing their provider and not you or I?
Yeah, and this is obviously my opinion. The three ways you test are blood, urine, and saliva. Of those, and I have a chapter on this, but the first one, saliva, I'm not a huge fan of salivary testing. I haven't really been able to find data that shows that it's reproducible or as reliable as the other two. It also costs money. And so it is good for cortisol, however. So cortisol testing, I will do saliva, but I don't do sex hormones with saliva. Serum or blood is extremely accurate because it's what's in your blood, but it's limited by the concept of timing. So it's only gonna tell you what's in your blood when the needle's in your arm. So you have to know when the period was, you have to know what the time of day was, if they're taking hormones exogenously by, you know, mouth or topically. And so you just have to know that information when you get blood tests. Blood is also covered by insurance in most instances, and it's relatively quick to get a response. So maybe a few days to get the results. It also checks for thyroid and vitamin D, which saliva and urine usually do not. So that's important. Urinary testing is a great test in the sense that it tends to be 24 hours. So it's a bigger picture. It checks all the sex hormones and their metabolites, which is nice because sometimes we want to know how you're getting rid of your estrogen in your body or how you're breaking down your testosterone. It checks melatonin, it checks cortisol, it checks vitamin B levels and some neurotransmitters. So it's a great test and it gives us a wider spectrum. The downside of like Dutch testing is that it's about $350, not covered by insurance, takes about 3 weeks to get the results back. So it's just a little bit longer and it doesn't check thyroid or vitamin D.
Yeah. So I am completely with you. I don't use salivary except for cortisol. Which can be helpful at, once again, cortisol is one of those things where you can't just look at it at a point in time. I always explain to patients that hormones are hard because they work in circadian rhythms. So if I check them in the morning versus checking them at night, they could be different. You know, if you just exercised, if you're sick, what time of the month it is, the first of the month to the next to the first of the month, you know, women are going to make differing levels of hormones. And so that's the hard part about hormone testing is that you have to test it repeatedly sometimes to actually see trends or problems. And of course, there's inaccuracies with salivary or urinary because sometimes there's some genetic differences too in the way that people metabolize. And so how I like to think of it I only use salivary, like I said, for cortisol. I use blood testing for a lot, of course, because it's covered by insurance. I do use the Dutch in my office, but I think the Dutch is good. Like, I kind of think of it as like an aerial view. So you got the drone coming over the house and it takes a snapshot, and then we can kind of figure out maybe what, you know, hole we should go down as far as focusing on symptoms. And I do like looking at the metabolites. Like you mentioned, I think it's important the way that I describe estrogen as like use it and lose it. So you want to make sure it's not hanging around. And those pathways are super important. And I don't think women, you know, understand those pathways, and that can contribute to something you mentioned earlier, like estrogen dominance. Yeah. And then when you talked about optimal ranges, that can be different too, even from lab to lab, what people might consider normal. But I think one of the other inaccuracies when people say, you know, go to their doctor and say, can you check my labs, is if they want thyroid checked, only a TSH is getting checked. Or if they want testosterone checked, like only a total testosterone, right? Not looking at free testosterone or sex hormone binding globulin or like other things that can affect it. So let's start with that first archetype that you talked about, the nun. So, because I think this is there's going to be a ton of women listening to this that are saying, oh my gosh, that's me. So talk a little bit about, of course, like the, you know, ICD-10 hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Like, where do you even start with this nun archetype?
So the unfortunate thing, you know, is that it's listed as a psychiatric disorder.
We're doing women so much service.
Just basically saying, women, if you don't want sex, it's your problem. Whenever guys show up, and I am not a relationship expert, I'm divorced, so I'm not going to put myself out there, but I will tell you this. Number one is she doesn't have sex with jerks. I always tell guys that when they come in. And number two, rather than putting your moves on in the kitchen, do the dishes. You know, I mean, it's like, tell her to go have a seat and relax, because in most instances for women, the sexual response is way more energetic consuming than for a guy, you know? So yes, when you have low testosterone, I've often said low testosterone, if it was a t-shirt, would just say meh. Like, it's just, that's kind of how you feel. Like, things that you used to like to do, you just kind of aren't interested anymore. Or you're specifically, I noticed the stories that would come through, they're tired, especially in the afternoons, like 4 or 5 o'clock, they're wanting to take a nap. Obviously sex drive, because sex is energetic. So if you're just worn out, you're not going to be interested in sex because you need the energy to do that. Hair thinning is actually a big one. The hair follicles are anabolic. So if you have low, people often think of high testosterone for hair loss, which is true, but if it's super low, it can also cause hair thinning. So along with low thyroid. So there's a lot of symptoms, but most of the time it's completely ignored. Like you said, half the time the right labs aren't drawn. They're just getting a total testosterone, which is helpful, but it doesn't give you all the information you need. And the other thing with the, you know, and the reason that I called it the nun is it's because obviously good nuns don't have sex. But nuns are also good in the sense that that time period for you, you tend to be more reflective because you're just usually at home more. When does becoming a nun, when is that bad? Well, nuns sometimes will take a vow of not just chastity, but they will cloister. So they'll stay inside all the time. That's just one of the things they do at some of these institutions. And so some women that have low testosterone will just stay indoors. They won't go out. They won't do anything because they just don't feel like it. So one of the six steps that I have for helping the nun is to get outside, go do stuff, make yourself at least just go out and get in the sun, because we know that will lift moods and get things going. So there's things that you can do other than just taking testosterone that will help. You know, you being a big weightlifter is another thing for testosterone. And you probably know a lot more about that than I do, even because you do that for a living. But, you know, taking the right amount of protein and fat versus carbs and all that stuff. So yeah, the nun is certainly number one far and away, and, you know, can have even acne with low testosterone sometimes, or depression and anxiety can be hormonally related to this one.
Yeah, I think things that I find drive down testosterone, of course, people eating a low-fat diet. So we need fat and cholesterol to make our sex hormones. Insulin resistance is a big one. You know, you think, oh, insulin resistance, PCOS, but, you know, some insulin resistance can actually drive down your testosterone because you aromatize it a lot to estrogen. Talk about testosterone replacement for women. That's kind of a controversial thing.
So there's different types. There's sublinguals, there's capsules, there's topical creams, there's vaginal creams, there's pellets. I am unabashedly against pellets, have been for years. I'm just not a fan. I've written a lot about it and I won't belabor it here. I just think that testosterone levels, I've seen so many women with pellets that have testosterone levels in the male range around 300, 400 sometimes. And it makes them feel horrible, aggressive, anxious, irritable. Some women feel okay, but a lot don't. So pellets, I'm not a huge fan of for women. For guys, you know, they can go high because if a man is high in testosterone, they're just a bigger jerk than they probably would have been in the first place. But and it can aromatize the estrogen, like you said.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem that I experience in my community is that pellets are a cash pay procedure. And so what happens is you have people that shouldn't be treating women with hormone replacement therapy doing it. And that's where I have seen, you know, patients come from like other clinics with somebody that's not, in my eyes, adequately qualified to really be messing with someone's hormones. And these levels can get super therapeutic, or their goal is super therapeutic levels and not necessarily physiologic, you know, optimal levels.
Yeah, they routinely shoot for over 100 on a testosterone level, and women should cap out around 50, depending on their free testosterone. But regardless, yeah, it's uneducated.
So these other routes, like what do you find to be the best clinically in your practice?
I usually will start with topicals just because we can put more than one hormone in there. So you can do estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, DHEA. And I find that maybe one out of every 15 women that I put on topicals don't absorb. So I will switch to sublingual tablets. The downside to sublinguals is that you'll get a spike and then a drop just because it absorbs super fast. And I like creams because they're just a little more, the levels are very, you know, stabilizing, and you just put it on every day. But those, the two big ones that I use are topicals and sublinguals.
Yeah, I think the hard part sometimes about creams and gels or things that are topical is, especially when we're talking about vaginal dosing, like women perceive them to just be like messy and they don't want to deal with it. And of course, there's always a risk of transfer. I've seen patients, you can transfer it onto your partner, you can transfer it onto a pet, you can transfer it onto your children. So you have to be careful about where, you know, your application is happening. So there's, of course, you know, all these, you know, pros and cons. And I'm with you. I've had patients that don't absorb well with one route and we have to try another route. So it's not a one size fits all. You know, this route is the best for everybody. It's so individualized as to how you absorb it and where we can get your levels and how you feel and so many variables there. So with the nun archetype, let's say you optimize testosterone, but they still like don't feel great. What other options do they have?
Well, so I guess you can look at it and say, well, if your levels are optimized, obviously I can't keep giving you more. And I would tend to look at what those symptoms are that aren't getting better. It's possible that, you know, it could be, you know, another hormone, like if they're not sleeping, maybe they're taking the testosterone too late in the day, or it is too high, or they need progesterone. I think it's, and that happens. I probably would say that on a first try, like if I see somebody do labs, put them on something, probably half the time you have pretty good success the first time around. But I was going to make a mention with you talking about that is that I think the key to success is when you find somebody like you or me is staying with that person for follow-ups, because we can fine tune things and change courses, and hormones will change 1 or 2 years down the road too. So a lot of the women that I've had with me for years, I'm making adjustments probably every 6 to 12 months because something changes in their lives. But the problem is if they're going from place to place, you can't ever really get a feel for what's going on because they're moving around. So I would also say, once you find somebody that you like, just stay with them.
I totally agree. I've seen patients that have bounced from place to place to place. I'm like, okay, listen, who's managing this? Like, who's running the show? But they've also been told, like, you know, different things at every provider and at every stop. And so I think it can be frustrating sometimes for patients. Hormone replacement therapy, I think in general, and I'd love to dive into that, but let's go through the other archetypes. So I think the second one you talked about was estrogen dominance. What does this archetype look like? I think this is something that I definitely see a lot.
So you've got your patient who probably has a little bit of more of an issue with probably obesity, headaches, breast tenderness, thyroid dysfunction. If you think of estrogen as being very stimulating and progesterone being very calming, they're constantly just being stimulated by estrogen. So they tend to be maybe more irritable, higher chances of probably fibroids or endometriosis, heavy, painful periods or not having periods for maybe 3 to 4 months and then having heavy periods, and having insulin resistance, which you brought up earlier. So you just have a higher propensity for weight gain and things like that. I tend to find that the reason I call it the queen is because the quintessential female hormone is estrogen. And the biggest person I could think of power-wise was a queen. But you can be an off with your head type queen, which is kind of what estrogen dominance is.
Interesting. Interesting. I love those analogies. It like makes it stick, you know, in your mind. So of course, a lot of times what happens when patients come in complaining of some of the symptoms, they'll just get put on a birth control pill, right? And a lot of times that's not really fixing the problem. So how does somebody more naturally go about fixing an estrogen dominant situation?
Yeah, so birth control pills are sort of estrogen dominant. I mean, I think that the pills themselves, especially women that are just going continuous, like doing 3 months at a time or whatever. But what I tend to do is look at this in a couple of ways. One is going to be trying to, if it's low progesterone combined with high estrogen, that's called the mother, because the low progesterone is the unbalanced heroine. And if you put a queen with a hero, you get a mother. So those women, you want to bring their progesterone levels up, which sometimes you need to give them progesterone. And getting estrogen down depends, one, on why it's there in the first place. Obviously, if they're taking estrogen, you want to change their dose. Fat cells make estrogen, so obviously working with them on nutrition and weight loss is going to be huge long term. But also making sure that their body is eliminating estrogen through the liver and the GI tract. So if you increase fiber intake, fiber will hold on to estrogen in the gut. And then some women actually can use a supplement called beta-glucuronidase, which will inhibit our beta-glucuronidase.
Calcium deglucurate.
And it's it blocks the enzyme in your gut that allows the estrogen to cleave it off and come back in. So you can eliminate more. I've had some women half their estrogen levels by just taking a supplement like that. I'm a big fan of maca. I think maca sometimes can help if you use a good quality brand. But usually estrogen dominance, in my opinion, is probably one of the more difficult things to fix because it's going to be lifestyle changes and long-term changes. So working with somebody like you that focuses not just on the hormones, but on what you're eating, what your exercise routine is, that's what's where the real change is going to happen.
Yeah. And it's difficult. Like, how do you get people to do what you think they should do? And I think that's why Western medicine is the way it is because people, they want a prescription. They want something quick and fast. And unfortunately that comes at a cost, because if you just take a birth control pill, you know, and then when I see the patient years later and they come off of it and now they want to get pregnant, you know, depending on where this woman is in her lifetime, it can really create these issues if she hasn't dealt with them. And maybe it's just her normal, you know, I mean, some of these things, we all have different you know, genetic differences and those types of things. Interesting. You mentioned beta-glucuronidase. I recently did GI mapping on myself. I don't have, I used to have PCOS, but I've checked my estrogen levels and I'm leaner now. So my estrogen levels are very normal. I have very normal periods, but I have really high beta glucuronidase activity and I don't take calcium D-glucarate, but now I'm like, oh my gosh, should I be on calcium D-glucarate? Yeah. So I think that those lifestyle things can even overcome, you know, whatever your, you know, baseline is for some of these things. Yeah.
But like you said, sometimes getting that message across to the point where they want to do it, you have to be ready. You have to be wanting to do it. Like, you know, I watch a lot of your Instagram stuff. I mean, you have a routine. You have, you know, you have habits that you have created over the years. Probably in many instances, people would be like, well, I'm never going to be Miss Nebraska. But you get to that point because of the habits that you have. Mm-hmm. And even just changing a couple of things, like eliminating soda or, you know, something simple can cut 10 pounds off of your body in a few months. So it's hard. It's a harder sell, like you said. It's definitely a harder sell.
Well, I think the reason that it's so hard, and this is me coming from a place of where I used to be overweight. I used to have prediabetes. I used to have hypothyroidism. And I'm very busy. And so people are like, I don't know how you do it. I think really honestly, for anybody listening, what really the deciding factor is changing your internal language. So like, if I relate this to your book, Sean, I think that, you know, you take somebody like the archetype, right? Where they're just like, well, I'm a fat person. When you have language that says like, I'm a fat person, or I'm estrogen dominant, or I just have low sex drive, or whatever it is, when you have that internal language, those words and those thoughts are what create your actions. Those are what create your daily habits. And so a lot of times when people really want to be different, I mean, you can tell them all day, well, just like do this. But what actually creates those behavior changes for people is changing the language. And you really almost have to make a declaration of who you are before you are that person. But when you say like, I'm strong and I'm fit, and that's what I did, is I'm like, I'm strong and I'm powerful. And then that starts translating into those daily habits. And I know it's easier said than done, but I just think it starts so much more with kind of our internal language about who we are and who we've, and it's okay to reinvent yourself. Like, I mean, I was at a point in my life 5-6 years ago where I was ready to make these changes and change who I was. And, I think women go through like these phases of their life, right? So they're like, they go through the years of, you know, becoming a woman and then going through the years of fertility and then this transition into menopause, and we're different people every decade of our life. So, okay, so let's go to the third archetype that you thought was the most prevalent, which was hypothyroidism or low thyroid function. Talk to me about thyroid testing. Thyroid is obviously something that women encounter a lot more than men.
Yeah, and normally it's a TSH, which is a pituitary hormone that basically just tells us how your brain is talking to your thyroid gland. So it's not super sensitive. There are so many women that I see that come in that have a lot of symptoms of low thyroid, but they've been told multiple times that their thyroid function is fine, and it's because of the TSH being normal. So I tend to recommend drawing, if at a bare minimum, TSH and a free T3, which is the T3 is the active thyroid hormone, T4 is the storage form, of getting a free T4 and a free T3, because those are what help. Some people will order what's called reverse T3 and antibodies. I will occasionally order thyroid peroxidase antibodies, which looks for Hashimoto's, which is the number one cause of thyroid dysfunction in women, or thyroglobulin antibodies, which can be Graves' disease or other things that's more hyperthyroid. But yeah, I will get a more extended panel, and I tend to focus more heavily on the free T3 number, mm-hmm, when I'm talking about symptoms. So women that, you know, have, I call them underdogs, because they have all the raw materials almost to be the person, the woman they want to be, but they're just functioning kind of behind the scenes because they can't get the energy to really get they're, you know, they're like walking in mud. They want to go to sleep. They wake up tired. You know, they've gained, you know, 10, 20 pounds. They're losing their hair. you know, just kind of feel older than they really are. And they have the potential, but they just don't have the stuff to get there. And so they're underdogs in that sense. And because what I find is by helping them correct their thyroid, which obviously can be interactive with other hormonal imbalances, especially estrogen, it's life-changing for some of these women. They're still in the normal range for their age group, but they feel 100 times better.
Mm-hmm. Could not agree more. Could not agree more. Do you use, like for instance, I was going to ask if you use desiccated thyroid or what other, you know, thyroid you use in your practice?
I do. I use glandulars because of the fact that I see so many women that are on Synthroid or Tyrosine that is just T4. And the problem is they're not converting. So I always say it's like you have a lot of money in the bank, but you can't spend any of it. And spending is what gives you the joy. So you're looking at your thyroid levels are normal, but you're not able to convert it. And so the glandulars have like 80% T4, 20% T3. So you're kind of getting the more bang for your buck.
Yeah. So for people listening that don't understand that, traditional treatment of hypothyroidism is replacement with levothyroxine, Synthroid, euthyrox, whatever name you want to give it, but it's T4 replacement. T4 gets converted into T3 in the body, which is the active thyroid hormone. Whereas we have options to use what we call glandulars, which are desiccated pig thyroid, or there's over-the-counter desiccated beef thyroid that contain some T4 and some T3. And the interesting thing for me was I used to have hypothyroidism and I was on just levothyroxine. And I knew on the levothyroxine, I felt the best if my TSH was 1. And that was all my doctor was checking my TSH, get the TSH to 1. And that is where I clinically felt the best, which is great. But what's interesting is years down the road after I got off of my medication, and I believe my hypothyroidism was related to my insulin resistance, I did some genetic SNP testing because I was, you know, down the rabbit hole of like genetics and nutrigenomics and all of these things. And I have the enzyme where I don't convert my DIO, I think it was my DIO1, DIO2, one of them, but basically I don't convert to T3 very well. And so it's interesting to me to think, would I have felt better using, you know, a glandular or a desiccated thyroid? I don't know, because my doctor never even checked free T3 levels back then. But I find clinically that some patients do feel better taking them. There's a small subset of patients that I do have on, you know, straight T4. It's always, of course, these individual, you know, variants and things like that. But it's, you know, a controversial area because of some of the societal recommendations, you know, to not use it or
endocrinologists love to, I have patients, I'll go see an endocrinologist after they see me and they'll take them off all their glandulars. Like, yeah. They're just like, oh, you don't need to be on that. And they're like, but I feel better. It's like, no, you need to be on this. And so they'll switch them back. And it's like, I don't understand. Luckily I have a couple endocrinologists here in town that actually use glandulars if I need to refer for something weird. But it's really frustrating when, you know, you get this idea that, you know, it's like us against them. And the reality is we should all just be, if the patient feels better, maybe the doctor should say, huh, what are you on? Oh, that's weird. I mean, I need to look into this. Instead, they just kind of snub the whole category. And these are medications that are prescriptions that have been around forever. You know, they've been around for a long time. It's not like this is something we made up. It's just that they're not chosen to be utilized by certain doctors. So I don't know why it gets such negative feedback from the other, you know, the traditional medical community.
Yeah, well, I think like a lot of things in medicine, there's a lot of politics involved. I know when I was going through my integrative medicine fellowship, there was like a short supply of desiccated thyroid. It was hard to find NP thyroid and Armour. And I had been told that somebody had bought a factory that was producing one of them in the US and converted it over into only making like levothyroxine and Synthroid. So there was like a huge shortage and supply chain issue. And then, of course, recently there was a recall on one that I used to. And so, you know, I think there's so many politics involved with pharmaceuticals. I was just talking to my media guy right before we got on this podcast, and he's like, you should do an entire podcast on insurance systems and like your perspective as a doctor, because it's really hard as a physician to practice the way that we want. A lot of times our hands are tied behind our back as far as what's formulary, what's covered, or patients are having to pay cash pay for certain things. And it's super frustrating as a medical provider.
Yeah, I tend to use NP thyroid more than the other brands, but what I find is it's really funny is some pharmacies, the insurance will cover is $10. I have other patients will call me back and they'll say they're trying to charge me $300 for this NP thyroid. There's a pharmacy here in Texas around Dallas that has a cash price where you get 90 pills for, I don't know, $75. So it's like, how can it be three different prices? Why is it just not the same? Or, you know, and it's really interesting, but yeah. And that's the thing is I can't keep track of, and that's just one medication. Imagine, you know, all the stuff that we are used to using. And then there's certain pharmacies, like I'll just say CVS, because this is the pharmacy. They specifically don't like NP thyroid because mm-hmm. of the cost. And I think they will switch patients or try to switch them to Armour, which I think they make more money on or something. But it's funny because they jack up the price of NP thyroid. So it's almost, you know, so I don't usually go to CVS. I'll go to Walgreens or something instead. So it's just knowing all that by listening to your patients come back and tell you stuff.
Yeah, I've seen the same thing in my community with particular pharmacies wanting to interchange things. And I'm sure it's due to profit margins and not due to insurance formularies and those types of things. So it's super, super. And what people don't understand is this creates tons of extra work and logistical issues for our own offices and our own practices. Like when this was happening in our community with one particular pharmacy, I mean, I have, you know, 100 patients on this medicine and this pharmacy is trying to jerk these patients around. It's creating more phone calls for them, more, you know, work for my nurse. I'm trying to see patients. It's maddening sometimes.
Even if it's a 5-minute call, you multiply that times 100. I mean, that's 2 days out of your, you know, that's a lot of time.
Yeah. Another area where I like to bang my head against the wall is when it comes to hormone replacement therapy for postmenopausal women. Is I can sit in a clinic room and I can lay out every single option this woman has. And then I get back to my computer and it's like, none of this is covered or only this is covered. And she's pigeonholed into like, you know, one therapy.
And that's another reason why I think bioidentical compounded hormones are great, because I can put estradiol, progesterone, testosterone, DHEA, I could put all four of those into a prescription and it's $45. Mm-hmm. So it's not like gobs and gobs of money, you know? But yeah, sometimes, I mean, and that price varies around the country. So, mm-hmm. Some places charged $100, but most, it should be fairly affordable, even lower almost than some prescriptions that you would send, like for, you know, estradiol or something, because it, like you said, it's not covered. So they'll charge, you know, if you call a pharmacy and you say, what's the cash price? They'll say, oh, it's $50 if you pay cash. But then if you go use your insurance, somehow it's $150. You know, yeah. It's like, because that's what your insurance company is contracted for. So that's what you have to pay. But if you would have just told them you were cash, it would have been one third of what you're paying. So I don't even know how to keep up with any of that, to be honest.
Yeah. So you talked about compounded bioidenticals. So one thing I want to maybe just delineate is there's compounded, which means that this pharmacist is, you know, like mixing it up, a combination of whatever Dr. Chasson and I have determined that, you know, you need. And then there's bioidentical, because there are some bioidentical prescriptions. Can you tell people the difference or what kind of your thoughts are and opinions kind of about bioidentical versus not bioidentical?
So the bioidentical estradiol, progesterone, testosterone technically look similar to your natural hormone. There are a lot of prescription, non-compounded, estradiol, like estrace, prometrium is progesterone. There is no testosterone replacement for women. There used to be methyl testosterone. I think it's still available. It's a horrible medication. I'd never prescribe it, but, so the bioidenticals, what's interesting is that the bioidentical that you get from Walgreens is going to be the same bioidentical that you would get compounded. It's just the delivery system. There are no real topicals. There's vaginal creams, but they have to patent it. They have to be able to patent the hormone So what they do is they patent their delivery system, which is why it gets to be more expensive. So like Prometrium, which is micronized progesterone, is suspended in peanut oil. That's how they got it patented. So it's similar. It's a similar product. And so I'm not opposed to those at all. I don't prefer oral estrogens because we know they can break down into more carcinogenic forms of methoxyestrones if they are taken orally versus topically. So I do prefer topical estrogen if I can use that. But yeah, the bioidentical, so the synthetic one that I had when I was growing up was Premarin. And Premarin was around forever, but it's made out of horse urine. So that's how they get the estrogen. And, so that's a synthetic because it's really interesting. Premarin has never, ever in the lifespan of its year, it never been generic. And it's because in order to go generic, you have to know, sorry, they're doing a wind blower. In order to go generic, they have to know everything that's in there because they have to put it in there. And Premarin, Wyeth, who made it, could never list, I think past, there were 18 things, and then past that, they didn't know. They couldn't list it all. And so it never went generic, and it's probably a good thing. But yeah, it's the synthetics also, bioidenticals will be like more of a lock and key system. They fit the keyhole, whereas synthetics, they hit the keyhole and they don't they can still open the door. Actually, sometimes they hit it even harder. Xenoestrogens, like stuff in the, chemicals and pesticides, those things can act like estrogens. Those are synthetic. They're xenoestrogens, but they hit those receptors sometimes harder than a regular hormone. So that's why you have to be careful.
Yeah. So I think like the word bioidentical sometimes just gets misconstrued that it's like, that it's more natural or whatever, but basically bioidentical are usually plant-derived hormones. They're just chemically, similar structurally to the ones that are produced by our body. And the biggest, problem is that there's just less FDA regulation. You have to trust that the pharmacist is compounding it correctly, that there's the correct amount of medication. So, people believe that there's less oversight, and that's why traditional Western medicine doesn't like it, because they just feel like prescription is safer because of the FDA oversight and you can write a prescription for it. But really there are bioidentical hormones that are prescription, like Dr. Sun mentioned, micronized progesterone. I use that in my practice too. And I totally agree with what you said about oral estrogens. I don't use them. I like sublingual or transdermal routes a lot better, and they're safer because of a reduced risk of blood clot and stroke as well in certain patients with risk factors. So since you've been doing hormone replacement therapy longer than I have, can you talk a little bit about like over the course of your career? Because what I, see is a lot of women come in, they're very afraid of hormone replacement therapy. They're convinced it's going to cause breast cancer, and they don't want to put that inside their body. Can you talk a little bit about hormone replacement therapy kind of over your career and just like the history of it?
Well, I was practicing when the Women's Health Initiative came out. The Women's Health Initiative basically just said what we already knew. It was all what was already in the package insert. There was a slight increased risk of breast cancer and DVT, blood clots in the legs. But we already knew that. And it was only for Premarin and Provera, which were two synthetic estrogen progestin formulas. The day that study started hitting, I think probably half of my patients called and wanted to go off of their hormones. And it did. It scared everybody. And we had to wait for a while before ACOG, our college, came out with a statement on everything. And it was probably a good 6 to 12 months before we even knew what the heck are we supposed to do, So when I first started, yeah, everybody got Premarin. It was Premarin, Premarin, Premarin. Maybe an occasional estrace, which is a bioidentical estradiol, but mostly the synthetic estrogens. And then I can remember there was a new one that came out that was soy-based, that was bioidentical, and then the gels started coming out. Prometrium's been out, or micronized progesterone, that came out, probably 10, 12 years ago. It's been around. That was the first bioidentical hormone after estrace that we had that we could use. There's never been an FDA-approved form of testosterone therapy. It's never been out there. I know there's been a couple that's tried to get FDA approval. There was a sexual desire drug that came out called Adi. What was that, like a 7 years ago?
Maybe. Mm-hmm.
And that one was more of an antidepressant than an actual drug. It was, so again, telling women it's all in their heads. Yeah. Again. And actually what was funny about that, and that I had, it was really funny, is I prescribed it one time because she really just wanted it. And second, it was one of those things where you couldn't drink alcohol because it makes your blood pressure drop. So what, you know, and I'm not saying that every woman drinks, but most women probably go home and have a glass of wine or something. And so who could actually even take it? I don't know. But yes, not only.
Well, and I think in the study, it was like one additional sexual encounter per month or something like that. Is that clinically significant? I don't know.
Life in general, if you play your cards right, I think. So it's like, what was it? Not just patients were afraid of the Women's Health Initiative, but GPs, family practice docs, so afraid still now. I mean, you probably see them. People will come in and their doctors are like, I don't want to put you on hormones. And it's like, we have this general fear that estrogen causes breast cancer. And I often will say, estrogen doesn't cause breast cancer. If it did, then every woman would get breast cancer. It can potentiate a breast cancer cell that has an estrogen receptor on it, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily causing it. There's so many things that cause breast cancer. And it's probably a combination of all those things. But we know that it can prevent osteoporosis. It helps with lipid function and heart disease. And those are bigger problems than breast cancer, long-term, I think, number-wise. And so I even have patients that have breast cancer that I have on hormones just because I've known them for years and they can't live their lives. They can't be the woman they want to be because they're suffering, and they are willing to take the risk of possibly stimulating a breast cancer cell. But that's just with people that I know that they trust me, and we have that discussion about risks. It's really unfortunate that we're so afraid of hormones.
Yeah, I think there's so many women that could benefit due to the cardioprotective and the bone health, the brain health. So I pulled this study that was published just back in 2019, looking at it's titled "Hormone Therapy Linked to Improved Cognition in Postmenopausal Women." And that's why I'm really starting to see the pendulum swing and the conversation really open up for a lot of these women, because I think there are people who are afraid of it that could see a lot of benefit to it are just afraid. So I'm happy to kind of dispel some of those rumors. Talk about vaginal estrogen therapy, because it's not the same as systemic therapy. And in my personal opinion, I think 100% of women should be on vaginal estrogen therapy. Even with a history of breast cancer, it's really safe. So can you talk about the differences with vaginal versus systemic?
That's a big sign for estrogen deprivation, vaginal thinning and just kind of dryness. I do find that in my practice, most women that take oral therapy tend to get enough systemic so that it does help the vagina. But I do have some women that'll do both. Maybe once or twice a week, they'll do the vaginal gel, especially for women that are super afraid of the systemic action. So they just want to focus. There's a estring and things like that just focus on vaginal health. And that's I think super important, because it's important for sex drive and having great relationships. So definitely think that vaginal estrogen should be part of the conversation, especially if they're not bringing it up. And it's something that certainly helps a lot.
Yeah, I think it can provide a huge benefit. And when we talked about sexual dysfunction in women, vaginal dryness, pain with intercourse, these can be reasons, you know, why women aren't initiating, you know, sexual activity with their partners. And so treating these vaginal symptoms, I think, are so important. And there's a variety of ways that you can dose it. Oh my gosh, if you guys can hear my dog, I'm so sorry. Somebody clearly wants my attention at the front door right now, and so does he. But we're having a good conversation, so I'm not editing this out. So, you know, when it comes to vaginal estrogen therapy, there's creams, there's gels, there's pills, but what I was talking about earlier with insurance, it's like sometimes my hands are tied as far as the delivery method, because I do love some of the pills and capsules and rings, but sometimes we can't get those covered. So But vaginal estrogen therapy is very safe, even for patients with a history of breast cancer. You can use it in even like 4 microgram doses in these patients, or there's other preparations like vaginal DHEA that basically locally get converted into estrogens. But estrogen is what provides kind of that plumpness, the lubrication to that tissue. And as it thins out and gets really dry, it's more prone to trauma. These women are more prone to urinary tract infections and all sorts of things. So I'm a huge fan of vaginal estrogen replacement therapy, even if a woman, you know, chooses not to do systemic replacement. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so we're going to go just to my last part here of my podcast, which I like to call the semen analysis. I think it's such a great name. If I do say so myself, I'm a gynecologist, right? So in the semen analysis, I kind of give my opinion on the topic, and you guys already heard I'm a huge fan of hormone replacement therapy. So I'd pulled this study looking at hormone therapy linked to cognition in postmenopausal women. And basically what they looked at was that extended estrogen exposure and long-term hormone therapy shows a benefit for cognitive function. And this was published in the North American Menopause Society. My dog is still on fire, you guys. I'm so sorry. But the study authors analyzed the impact of the window of time. So this was 2,114 postmenopausal women. The mean age was 74 years, and it was a 12-year population-based study in Utah. I think one of the biggest things with the WHI trial that you brought up was that the population in the WHI trial was an older population. Many were obese, many were smokers, and those people aren't good candidates for hormone replacement therapy to begin with. So I think patient selection, you know, is super important. But the reason I bring this up is I'm, of course, very passionate about nutrition and its impact on hormones. And for postmenopausal women, as they lose their estrogen, it increases the risk of visceral fat deposition. It increases the risk of insulin resistance, cardiovascular disease. But dementia is such a huge one. And Alzheimer's disease is now being called type 3 diabetes. And women compromise 2/3 of about the 5.5 million people that are being diagnosed with Alzheimer's in the United States. So much more than men. So this is an important thing in the women's health world. But I think the important thing to highlight out of this study is that there appears to be kind of a golden window of opportunity for hormone replacement therapy. And it really seems to be when you're about to go through menopause and then you go through it in those first 5 to 10 years after menopause, because hormone replacement therapy doesn't appear to provide a lot of reversal benefit, but it has a lot of protective benefit. So it's better for a woman to initiate it at the time of menopause and not 10 years later. And I explain that to patients all the time. I'm like, listen, I know you're scared, but if you come back to me at age 65 and you've got osteoporosis and heart disease and dementia, and now you want estrogen, there doesn't seem to be, you know, as big of a benefit. And most providers only really give it for vasomotor symptoms like hot flashes or night sweats. And there's not a lot of, you know, guidelines that really promote it for the protection of these other things. But when I'm sitting across the clinic room from a patient and I'm talking about the things that are most likely to kill her or make her life miserable, neurologic dementia, Alzheimer's, I think are such a huge thing. Do you agree with that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't even think we know the depth yet of what we'll find. I think we did take a step back with the fear that was generated with the WHI. I think that we focused more on the breast cancer, which is scary, obviously, but the Alzheimer's is a big problem right now. And I think keeping cognitive function intact, I can't tell you how many people, you know, we see that complain about brain fog, you know, they just can't focus. And that's stressful for women. That's really stressful.
Yeah. So the conclusion really of this study was that hormone therapy is recommended for management of any menopausal symptom if they're under the age of 60 and within 10 years of their last menstrual cycle. And in this situation, the benefit really typically outweighs all risks involved. Of course, the hormone replacement therapy is about 90 to 95% effective at relieving vasomotor symptoms like hot flashes or night sweats. But it also protects the bones and the heart. And of course the brain, like we talked about, it's so important. Once you get into your 60s and your 70s, less favorable. So, well, that's the wrap up on the semen analysis. Dr. Tassone, tell people where they can find you. Can they become a patient? Where do they find your book?
So obviously the book is at major retailers, Barnes and Noble across the country, Amazon, obviously. I'm on Instagram, Sean Tassone MD. And Facebook as well, same thing. And posting about all kinds of things, hormone related and other things, like Esure and some other stuff. But I do take patients. I have, you know, I have to see people physically once a year in order to prescribe. So, but anybody obviously in Texas that wants to swing by, or if you're visiting and you want to come down to Austin, I take most insurance plans.
Yeah, I get asked all the time if I do telemedicine, but it's hard with these laws. You know, you have to have a license in the state where the patient lives. So same thing, you have to come visit Dr. Tassone once a year to be his patient. Well, thank you so much for your time. Yeah, I love your social media. I saw you making TikTok videos. So you're pretty advanced there.
When you embarrass your kids, maybe that's a good sign. I don't know, but I'm starting TikTok. A really good friend of mine is Tony Yoon, who's a plastic surgeon. He's got like 4.8 million followers on TikTok. But anyways,
wow.
I have 13, so I'm just starting. And but you got to start somewhere, and it's kind of fun. I have a great person here that helps me edit all those. So yeah, she just tells me what to do, and I do it, and then she makes this cool video.
I have a nurse in my clinic that's like a TikTok guru, but of course I feel like I can only spend my time, like, there's so many platforms. I would never be able to see a patient or take care of my kids or work out if I know. And of course you can cross post, which, you know, that helps, but I loved your TikTok video because, for those of you that haven't seen it, go check it out. It says like, what is the best birth control for women? And I watched the whole thing because I was like, okay, I got to see this. But basically at the end of the day, it was like, your partner should get a vasectomy, which is so, I run into this. I literally, probably this week, I would need both hands to count the number of conversations I've had with women about contraception. So, I was going to end the podcast, and now we got to talk about this topic because I think it's so important. But, you know, women can take hormones. So we have hormonal birth control, lots of different things, pills, patches, rings, vaginal inserts, long-acting reversible contraceptions like IUDs and Nexplanon. Of course, there's non-hormonal options. So we have one non-hormonal IUD called Paragard. And then, of course, you could use barrier methods and things like that, or permanent contraception. But I see so many women, and this is going to be my next gripe about insurance companies, so many women who have a partner that's not willing to even have the conversation about permanent birth control with vasectomy, or the insurance company, it's cash pay for the vasectomy, but the tubal ligation would be covered. So I have to take this woman and put her under general anesthesia to tie her tubes, whereas they'd have to pay, you know, out of pocket for a vasectomy. Do you encounter that too?
Oh yeah. And vasectomies are so much easier. I mean, I have a friend that's a urologist and he does like 15 in a day. I mean, when he does them, they're in the office. It's a tiny little incision, if any incision. And it's like 10-minute procedure. It's so much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. It's less invasive. And I'm not a man, so I'm not going to pretend that I have had to have that thought process or whatever it is. But I think, of course, I think men are afraid it's going to cause erectile dysfunction or they're not going to be able to ejaculate.
If you have a small penis before the vasectomy, you're going to have a small penis after the vasectomy.
Okay. That's good advice.
Tell them, and it has nothing to do with your penis. It's not going to change your penis. Let's say one more time, it doesn't affect your penis.
It doesn't change your testosterone levels. If you were a jerk before, you'll be a jerk after.
Oh, actually, probably more so now that you've said no. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, I always tell women too that partner vasectomy may not be lifelong birth control if you choose to have other relationships or you go through a divorce or something like that too. Because I've seen clinically a woman who used a partner vasectomy and had an ablation, but no tubal, and got a new partner and got pregnant after an ablation. So there's pros and cons to everything. So yeah, talk to your doctor about what's right for you. But, or if you want good education, just go find Dr. Tassone's TikTok because it's going to be popping. So, well, Dr. Tassone, thank you so much. Thank you for writing the Hormone Balance Bible and providing all the amazing education to these women, because I think being empowered with this as a woman is important. We don't talk about it. People, I find people's like, they said like, oh, my mom never talked about this. My grandma never talked about menopause, but nobody ever told me about periods. It's just sad. We're doing some injustice for women. So thank you.
Thank you.